Now we may proceed. Ms. Smith.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, ladies and gentlemen, counsel. I want to thank you for the opportunity to be here so close to you all today in Rhinelander. This case presents this court with the opportunity to give trial courts in the state of Wisconsin guidance on the constitutional limits on the use of technology, particularly closed-circuit TV, in the criminal justice process. Mr. Peters does not argue that there's no place for closed-circuit TV in the criminal process in Wisconsin. Clearly, and indeed, closed-circuit TV can and should be used and serves many useful purposes. The legislature has attempted to codify the permissible use of that sort of technology in 967.08 of the statutes. Mr. Peters does argue here today that closed-circuit television appearances cannot be used as a blanket substitute for the defendant's constitutional right to be physically present in the courtroom. There are cases in which the defendant's physical absence from the courtroom at a critical stage in the proceedings will rise to the level of a constitutional violation, which cannot be cured by the use of closed-circuit TV. This is one of those cases. Mr. Peters was arrested on April 3rd of 1996 for criminal traffic violations, including operating after revocation as a second offense. He was jailed, remained in jail, unable to post the $500 cash bond. On the following day, he appeared on a TV screen in the courtroom of Judge Schmidt of Shawano County. He was there at 1:45 in the afternoon via closed-circuit TV from the confines of the Shawano County Jail. He was not represented by counsel. The court called the case by saying, the state of Wisconsin versus Lawrence P. Peters. He is on closed circuit television. He's charged with operating under the influence, second, and operating with a BAC greater than 0.10, second, and operating after suspended license, also appears to be a second. If there are pleas other than not guilty, what would you recommend, Mr. Bruno? Mr. Bruno was the district attorney. He then proceeded to state, if the defendant chose to plead guilty, what he would recommend. Following that, the court gave the defendant a one-paragraph explanation of the fact that if he qualified...
Stand in front of the microphone,
sorry,
please.
If he qualified for the public defender's office, he would have an attorney. Otherwise, the court would have to make arrangements for him to get one. Do you want a lawyer? Or you can waive it. The defendant proceeded to waive his right to an attorney, pled guilty, accepted the recommendation of the DA. The court sentenced him to much less than the maximum potential penalty, a total of 35 days in jail. And when the defendant was asked if he had anything he wanted to say, what he said was, I'd like to have some time to make arrangements for my children. I'm a lone single parent. I have custody of all five of my children. And if I could possibly get word to them, make some arrangements for them, that's the only thing I need to ask. The entire proceedings takes up only 9 transcript pages. Subsequently, on May 25th of 1999, Mr. Peters was again arrested in Shawano County for operating after revocation, this time allegedly a fifth offense. The operating while revoked penalties are on a graduated scale based on the prior convictions that are counted. Before he pled guilty, his trial-level counsel then filed, and the court heard and decided his motion contesting the use of that earlier April 1996 conviction for purposes of counting prior offenses. He moved to void it for purposes of penalty enhancement.
Counsel, can I ask at this time, on the first waiver of counsel, I assume you're alleging what he did voluntarily waive his right to counsel the first time. Are you saying that he can't waive it because it was on closed circuit TV? What?
No, we're not saying that he can't waive it, but we're saying that you need to look
at... He did waive it.
He waived it, but you need to look at the totality of the circumstances of that appearance when you decide whether or not that's inherently reliable.
Cool.
And the circumstances of that brief waiver bear on that.
Was he coerced into waiving? I mean,
he was not coerced, but it was very unclear whether he had an absolute right to counsel. What the court said was...
I thought the court asked him if you wanted an attorney.
The court asked him if he wanted an attorney, and the court said, Now, the court advises you that you have a right to an attorney if your income, you have a right to an attorney if your income and assets are at the level the state public defender sets. The public defender would represent you. You may, however, waive your right to an attorney and proceed without one. If you wish to have an attorney, the court would take steps for you to go out and get one. That's all they said. He had already asked the state what they would recommend if he would plead guilty, prior to even going into whether he has a right to an attorney, and they never told him that he had a right to appear in court.
Well, counsel, you know about the Hahn case, obviously.
Yes.
You briefed that. And in the Hahn case, there's at least language that would indicate that the only issue you can raise as a collateral issue, thank you, that you can raise as a collateral issue is failure to have counsel, right?
That's true.
So let's just, we won't debate Hahn for the moment, but when I read through your briefs, I didn't really see you arguing that that here was a failure to have counsel. I mean, you didn't argue that you come within Hahn under the failure to have counsel.
No, I think...
Are you arguing that, or did I misread you?
No, counsel raised that issue. That's not the issue we followed up on. I think clearly counsel raised an issue of the constitutionality of that waiver of a plea. And I think clearly that waiver was defective. I think it's clear on the face of it. We didn't proceed to argue that because I think it is the use of technology issue that is most important here, and I think clearly the state waived the Hahn issue all along.
Is it the use of technology for the guilty plea, or is it the use of technology for the waiver of counsel, or is it both, or is it neither?
It is the use of technology for the plea and sentencing that occurred under the circumstances here, where he was not advised that he had a right to be in the courtroom. He never waived any right to be in the courtroom. He was unrepresented in the jail, a block from the courthouse. He had been in jail because he failed to make bail. And the court starts out by asking, if he chooses to plead, what would the state recommend? From the point of view of even an innocent person with five kids who don't know where their dad is, the fastest way out of jail is to plead guilty. And under those circumstances, it cannot be said that the plea taken in this case was reliable. And as long as it is not reliable, it should not be used to enhance Mr. Peters' punishment for the 1999 case that's actually what we're here on.
What is inadequate about the waiver of attorney?
The court never tells him that he has an absolute right to an attorney, and if that he can't afford one, one would be appointed for him. What they told him was, if you meet the public defender's criteria, you get one. Otherwise, we'll have to make arrangements for you to get one. And they never checked whether he knew. And the Kiefer case, I believe it is, specifies that the court has to make sure that the defendant understands that counsel may be able to find defenses or may be able to find ways around the prosecution and that it would be more difficult to proceed without it.
What has to be, you're suggesting it's inadequate. What has to be in the record for a court to find a knowing and voluntary waiver of counsel?
A knowing and voluntary waiver of counsel? I think it's the Kiefer case you need to follow.
So what should he have said? What should the judge have said here? Judge says, if you have income and assets at the level of state public defender sets, the state public defender would represent you. If you have more than this, he doesn't say this, but if you have more than the state public defender, will the court appoint counsel at no expense?
If you don't have the presently available money or assets to hire an attorney and you don't qualify for the public defender, you can apply to us. And we'll see if we can appoint one, and you can pay the county back. And more importantly, if you choose to waive, do you understand that an attorney may be able to assist you? Do you choose to proceed nonetheless?
You think that had to be in there?
I think that had to be in there, but I think even aside from that. I think the fact that he was there in court with the court not establishing that he understood that an attorney might be able to help him, might be able to find ways out of the predicament that he discovered, figures into whether the ultimate plea was valid.
Have you looked at the bench book to know what is suggested as a sufficient record for a knowing and voluntary waiver of counsel?
I have, and I do it on a regular basis, but I didn't do it to prepare for this because I didn't think that was the issue.
Okay. May not be. I'm just asking.
This was the initial appearance, was it not?
This was the initial appearance, but it was also the plea.
Was it the
arraignment.
Was it the sentencing?
And it was the sentencing. It was every proceeding he ever had in that case, to the best of my knowledge.
Well, wouldn't it be fair to say that there are lots of pleas and sentences meted out at the initial appearance?
That's true.
But now I don't know what the situation is in Shawnee County, but let's take a county like, say, Oneida County, where you have a courthouse and you have a safety building, which is several miles away. Is it your argument that as soon as the defendant indicated he might be willing to plead, the judge has to stop and say, don't plead, we got to bring you down to the courthouse to do this in front of me. Is that right?
I think that's one way they could have done it. I think when they're going to do initial appearances by video conferencing, there needs at least to be knowledge given to the defendant that if you're going to plead guilty and you want to be sentenced today, you have a right to do that in the courtroom. If that's what you want to do, we'll schedule those people for later and we'll do the pleas first. Trial courts regularly rank cases. Some counties, the cases where people appear with attorneys show up first so the lawyers can get back to work. Some counties, the cases where individuals without attorneys show up, and they get dealt with first. But courts routinely rank cases for convenience and so that all the rules can be followed. Cases where defendants are going to show up and plead guilty take more time than a simple initial appearance. So they often rank them. They have the court officer ask, how are you going to plead?
Well, do you have any objection to a not guilty plea taken this way?
No.
So it's only if the guy is going to plead guilty or not, no contest.
If you're going to enter a plea, that is the only determination of the ultimate issue that's going to happen. And the defendant does have a right to be out of the coercive atmosphere of a jail cell when he does it.
Well, I don't totally understand. 97104, I thought, was part of your argument. Under 97104, the defendant is to be present, and it lists a number of times during the proceedings when a defendant is to be present. Of course, one of those is what we have been discussing, that is imposition of sentence, but also sub A says arraignment. And you had suggested, I thought I heard your responses, you weren't saying that he had to be present in court in order to enter a not guilty plea. So help me with that argument.
We're talking about two separate issues. That's a statutory violation to do an arraignment when the defendant is to appear in court. The question, I think, in this case, given the peculiar procedural posture, is whether that error rises to a constitutional level. And while you may be able to skate by on a statutory violation for an arraignment, you should not be allowed to do that when you're pleading guilty and being sentenced.
Okay, well, even if we accept for the moment that this procedure is maybe violative of not only the statute but the constitutional due process, how can you get this resolved when we're not dealing with that case? We're dealing with another case. And the case we have here before us, he has a lawyer, right? And he's physically present in the courtroom.
Now, you're talking about the 1999 case.
Yes, the one that's right here before us. And Han says you can't bring into this case, this one before us, a challenge to a prior conviction, except when the offender alleges that a violation of the constitutional right to a lawyer occurred in a prior state conviction. And your main thesis here is the plea.
That's correct.
Okay, how do you get around Hahn?
There is always a very great danger in my standing here telling you what you mean when you said something last year. And I
we said it in September 7, 2000, right?
Right.
I even wrote it.
But I think we... First,
but
I don't...
Tell me what you think I said.
I think you gave us a safety valve. I think you gave us a safety valve in the corrected paragraph.
Okay, what you read the corrected paragraph?
I read the corrected paragraph as saying...
Read it to us, if you have it.
If the offender has no means available under state law to challenge the prior conviction on the merits, because, for example, the court never reached the merits of this challenge under State versus Escalona-Naranjo, and I mispronounced that name, I apologize.
Sorry.
Or the offender is no longer in custody on the prior conviction, the offender may nonetheless seek to reopen the enhanced sentence. Mm-hmm. The only word in here that doesn't fit is reopen, because counsel did it as efficiently as he could do it. Clearly, that 35-day sentence imposed in 1996, he was no longer in custody. He couldn't have been driving. Clearly, the time limits under Escalona-Naranjo had long since passed. This is the only venue he can to challenge it. There was a clear and complete record. The record was so complete that when Judge Grover was reviewing the record, he hadn't even noticed it was Judge Schmidt who was taking the earlier plea, and his decision says, I could see him, when it was, in fact, his compatriot across the hall. But it was available, it was clear, it was precise, and quite honestly, I don't think Hahn applies to this case at all, because I think the state waived the issue long ago.
Well, that's the argument you make in your reply brief, waiver. You do not make the argument about the opening that is in the Hahn case, which you have read to all of us. Are you saying that there was no way, you have no means under available state law to go back and open that, is it 96, conviction? Absolutely none.
I don't believe
he never appealed it. He never appealed it.
Never appealed it.
Never had a 97406.
And he was no longer in custody.
Post-conviction. He's no longer in custody, so he doesn't have habeas. But no way you can go back and open that up.
No way you can go back and open it, and under the circumstances here, where it was the same county, and the record was available, and all the information that would have been available to Judge Schmidt was also available to Judge Grover, it was the most efficient way to go about it. And to say that you should always go back to the trial court, I'm afraid, gives the state more than they want. Because if you're going back to the original trial court, you're obviously asking for more than simply don't count this conviction, it's not reliable. You want to go back then and reopen the whole can of worms. That puts the state in the position of, if the defendant is successful, retrying an old case. This is a shortstop position. They're simply saying it's not reliable enough to punish me again. It's not constitutionally reliable enough to punish me again. And that's the most efficient way to take care of a constitutional problem. Just don't punish him again for it.
Oh, yeah, but Hahn didn't say that. In fact, in Hahn, the
No, it didn't. I'm going beyond that. I agree.
Yeah, okay.
In Hahn, the question was, can you raise it?
That's right.
And here, I think, clearly the state waived it. The state was the one who was arguing Hahn. The state was preparing Hahn, and they chose never to raise it.
In the trial court.
In the trial court or in the Court of Appeals. They never raised it. It was the Court of Appeals themselves who raised the issue. And only to note that it was then pending. And the same state that's defending the Court of Appeals decision never raised it in the Court of Appeals.
Well, ordinarily, this is a procedural change, right, under Hahn. Procedure as to where you raise the issue. Ordinarily, a procedural change is retroactive to everything, right?
That's the general rule, except it isn't held so in criminal cases against defendants. In State v. Huebner, I'm looking at my note there.
Okay, bring your note and then talk into the microphone, because we're recording you, Ms. Smith.
I'm sorry. In State v. Huebner, that was one of the six-person jury cases. And he appealed, saying that the rule should be retroactively applied to him. And this court's response was, you knew that was coming up. You knew that that was an issue. You didn't raise it at the trial court. We're not going to give you the benefit of it. If you're going to apply that rule against criminal defendants in a system of justice, you need to apply it against the state as well. Particularly whereas here, the entire issue has been properly briefed, and this issue isn't going to go away.
The state was dealing with Hahn anyway.
The state was dealing with Hahn anyway?
Same party.
And in Huebner, it was a different defendant. And different defense counsel, to the best of my knowledge. But in here, the primary issue is whether or not you should stretch the use of technology to be a blanket substitute for a constitutional right. And under the particular facts of this case, that conviction was not sufficiently reliable to be counted as something you can continue to punish him for again.
Could I ask this? There are sometimes in these initial appearances public defenders standing by in the courtroom. Sometimes there are public defenders standing by at the jail. Could you discuss those two situations and whether that makes any difference to the result? Does the defendant still have to come to court?
The cases that the Court of Appeals cited with approval from Florida, the Scott case and Seymour and Williams, make a distinction I think makes a lot of sense. And in those cases, use of videotape procedures for plea were used. In those cases, the defendant had an attorney, had a plea bargain that had been worked out, and he had discussed it in advance with his counsel, and there was a waiver on the record, and usually in writing, of the right to be in court. If there's a public defender that's had the opportunity to discuss with the defendant and tell him if you plead guilty, this is what the DA is going to recommend, and in most cases, in traffic cases, they're standard recommendations. And you have the right to go into a courtroom if you're intimidated by the jail setting or whatever and enter a plea, or you can plead not guilty, or these are the things you can do. I think that would cure the issue, or it would go a lot further than what we have here. But we've got to have some guidelines, and you can't say you can go through and violate all the statutes with impunity when those violations clearly make the subsequent proceeding unreliable. We have a guy who's clearly worried about getting out of jail here. He hasn't had the right to talk to counsel. He is offered a plea bargain on the videotape. And in Seymour v. State, the Florida case that the Court of Appeals cites with approval, I think in a footnote, the proceeding was held not reliable because there was a defense attorney, and the defense attorney was in the courtroom. And he's telling the defendant over the TV, this is what the deal is, and they're having a conversation in the open courtroom. And the court said not every technological advance fits within the constitutional constraints or realities of criminal proceedings. We're most unwilling, even if the Fifth and Sixth Amendments permitted us to do so, to burden the stage of pretrial proceedings with such an impediment to effective communication. And they went on.
Let me ask this. What if you prevail here with this court, what happens then?
That depends on how you write it.
Okay, tell us how you want it to write, and give us alternatives.
Well, ideally...
Ooh, yeah, what's your ideal?
Ideally, if a defendant is going to plead guilty without an attorney, he ought to be in a courtroom. If a defendant is going to enter a plea by video technology, he needs to know he has a right to come to court and that nobody's going to hold it against him and that he can waive it if he chooses. And in a situation where he neither waives nor has counsel and does not have the benefit of a plea bargain negotiated in advance where he has the opportunity to look at the people he's negotiating with and evaluate them. That shouldn't be valid.
So your main argument is that you didn't have an opportunity to have counsel, so the, and I'm thinking of the technological changes, so if he has counsel, the person this is, and the counsel is there wherever it is, if it's here in Oneida County, and he fully understands, he or she fully understands her rights, are advised by counsel, then you're saying that would be acceptable. But the defect here was that this short colloquy on counsel, and that was because it took place. I'm not putting words in your mind. If you can,
I'm saying that's part of it. But you have to look at the coercive nature of being in jail in and of itself. We add that to the fact that he doesn't have counsel. He hasn't been advised that he has a right to be in the courtroom. And they offer him a plea bargain over the video where he doesn't have the opportunity to view the nuances of what's going on in the courtroom and make an evaluation. That shouldn't be constitutionally permissible.
Is this a due process-based argument, then,
yes,
or a right to counsel-based?
Due process.
Okay. So you're not relying on a right to counsel-based argument?
No, but we're saying that that figures into the totality of the failure of the process, to be fair.
Well, you keep getting back to that first offense. It's not his first offense, but the prior offense. But to get there, you still have to write an opinion that would get you there over Hahn. So how would you handle that?
Well, you have the right to take any case you want, first off.
Well, sure, but we also have the obligation to obey the law.
Absolutely. But in this case, I would truthfully get around this in several ways. And the first is you can't give the state the benefit of the new rules when you won't give them to defendants. They waived it.
That's the waiver argument.
Secondly, the second part of the clarification in Hahn has got to mean something. You wouldn't have bothered to do it if it didn't mean something. And Hahn says first, you have the right to bring the right to counsel argument. So that can't be what you're talking about. So it has to be an argument other than that. And this is a constitutional right other than the right to counsel argument. And if he has no other venue, it is better to give him this last-ditch chance to argue not that it should be vacated, but that it shouldn't be used to punish him again. And I would read Hahn to say that you tell us, make every other opportunity you can to go back to the original court. But if by the time you get here, there isn't any other opportunity yet, you have the right to at least raise it.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you, Ms. Smith.
Thank you.
I'm going to give you a couple of minutes to think about this, Mr. Gansner, because despite my lengthy notes, I missed two people that should have been acknowledged. And I want them to be acknowledged while the people from the Rhinelander mock trial team are here. And they are Dee Runis, who is with the State Bar and who works long and hard with the mock trial teams and supervising the formulation of the problem and then dealing with all the questions that come up from the 170 teams who nitpick you, right? And do a good job. So, Dee Runis. And attorney Charles Sen, who also works with the mock trial teams and, like Mr. Bloom, does this as part of his pro bono publico work without pay and because he's committed to law-related education. And I want to thank you personally and on behalf of the court, Mr. Sen. Mr. Gansner, now you're an old hand. That is one of long standing before the court who has appeared frequently. You don't get applause before, during, or after.
I understand that.
Okay.
Thank you for the additional time to prepare during the introduction. May it please the court. At the beginning of Ms. White's argument, I was impressed that there was more agreement between the parties on the issue of use of the closed circuit television than I had anticipated. In this sense, and I want to introduce my argument in this case by noting this area of agreement, Ms. White says that the defendant's argument is that closed circuit...
Smith.
Excuse me, Ms. Smith.
Can you will.
All right. Sorry, my opponent.
Do you want to start again?
Yes, I do. Thank you very much.
But just continue.
Thank you very much. Now that I'm grounded in reality, I hope, my opponent's argument is that closed circuit television should not be allowed to be used as a blanket means of avoiding or evading a defendant's right to appear in court. We agree. The state absolutely agrees. We're here only because there was a statutory violation of the laws of the state of Wisconsin governing the use of what the statute refers to as live audiovisual means by which a defendant may appear at certain proceedings. The violation that's here is one that the statutory violation is one that the state has admitted from the outset.
No, not arraignment. He was supposed to be present.
Supposed to be present and
sentencing.
And sentencing. And the statute that specifies the proceedings at which live audiovisual means can be used does not include what happened here. Mm-hmm. So this court has previously spoken that 97104, in which the legislature specifies the proceedings at which a defendant must be present, or this court has previously said that statute specifies those proceedings at which a defendant must be physically present. That's what the court said, I believe, in Veneman. The statute 96708, which implements or authorizes the use of telephone or live audiovisual means, operates within the area that 97104 has created. That is to say, the live audiovisual authorization or telephonic means of appearance of a defendant can be done, is authorized, in those cases where 97104 doesn't say the defendant must be present. So
is it the state's position then that video conferencing or what telephone is not physically present?
Excuse me?
Is it your position, is it the state's position that video conference is not being present under 97104?
Well, not that it's not being present, Your Honor, but it really depends. Here's our view on this, that there's a difference between physical presence and appearance.
Oh.
That there's two forms.
97104 just says present. Doesn't
right.
say physical presence.
It does
say
not.
Appearance.
That's right.
Just present.
This court in Veneman, however, referred to the statute as specifying physical presence.
Okay, so then do you think the court means physical presence?
Well, Veneman? That's what the court meant at the time of Veneman, and it's our view that the court ought to reconsider that position in order not to, at what is a relatively early stage in the development of live audiovisual or video conferencing, so that this court, it's our view that the court ought to reconsider that matter so as not to impose undue obstacles to the use, to the developing use of the technology that may be of substantial benefit to the court, to society, and to the defendants. But be that as it may, it's the state's position in this case that we're not interested in the use of video technology as a blanket means of making sure that defendants don't appear in court. That's not the state's position at all. What happened in this case was that an error occurred in the application of the statutes. The statutes weren't observed. Once this matter was raised 3 years later in the defendant's collateral challenge to his prior conviction, the judge reviewing the prior proceeding, Judge Grover, acknowledged that there had been a violation of the statute, and the question really became, what do we do with that? What's the significance of that? So I just want, before I go to the issue which frankly the state believes is the most important issue in this case, which is the matter of collateral challenges, what do we do about this? And what does this case mean, and what do we do in the aftermath of Hahn? I just wanted to state for the record that the defendant and the state are not miles half miles, quarter miles, or I don't think even meters apart in our views about what should be happening with closed-circuit television. We're not interested in seeing closed-circuit television used to evade the requirement that a defendant appear in court. On those circumstances where, certainly, where due process makes it clear that a live appearance would be essential, as opposed to those circumstances where an appearance by video means poses no obstacle whatsoever to a fair and just proceeding taking place.
And you agree there's a statutory violation, and the defendant agrees there's a statutory violation. Now the defendant says there was a constitutional violation in this particular case on video conferencing. So before you get to Hahn, what's the state's position? As I read the brief, I couldn't figure it out.
Okay. Our position is that the Court of Appeals got it right.
Which
is that even assuming there's a constitutional violation in this case, and I'm not trying to, I'll come back to it.
Go ahead.
Even assuming that there's a constitutional violation in this case, the violation was harmless. There was no prejudice to the defendant because nothing happened in this case that prejudiced this defendant's right to a fair and just proceeding. There is no evidence of any coercion. There's been references, vague allusions to circumstances being coercive, but no specific allegations and no evidence has ever been presented that the circumstances of Mr. Peters' appearance from a room at the Shawnee County Jail in front of a camera where he could see the judge in the courthouse and the judge could see him, there's been no specific allegation or evidence ever offered of any coercive atmosphere present there, nor has there been any suggestion that if Mr. Peters had in fact been brought to the courthouse and physically appeared before Judge Schmidt, anything in this case would have happened any differently than it did.
Why should the defendant have the burden of coming forth with evidence when it's conceitedly a statutory violation? Over the lunch hour, we had some question and answer stuff, and one of the answers given by one of the justices was essentially that rules infrequently enforced will be frequently violated. I think everyone's, trial court, court of appeals, state, defense, everyone's saying there's a violation of the rule here.
Mm-hmm.
But there are to be no consequences unless the defendant comes forward with evidence showing coercive behavior.
Well, there's a question here about upon whom the burden lies of demonstrating prejudice. But the state's willing to accept the burden in this case that, and I think that burden is satisfied, that there is no prejudice in this case. There is simply no evidence in this case that anything other than a quite routine appearance on a misdemeanor case took place.
Does this record reflect knowing and voluntary waiver of counsel?
Well, I believe it does, and I think the suggestion to the contrary by my opponent is frankly a red herring. I think the defense has conceded all along that they are not challenging the effectiveness of the waiver of counsel, and for the defense to be making a contrary argument now, I think flies in the face of their earlier concession that they weren't doing so. Yes, I believe this was a fully effective waiver.
So they would be, that argument you think is waived by them? Which is a segue.
Sure. I believe they've acknowledged it in the past that it's not in the Court of Appeals brief. It's not in the brief to their court. What they are suggesting is that what they view as the cursory nature of the advisement and waiver of counsel is somehow part of the atmosphere that this court ought to take into account in deciding whether the proceedings here were fair. And I would simply suggest to this court that what Judge Schmidt did in 1996 contains all the three necessary elements of an effective waiver. The defendant was informed of his right to counsel, was asked if he wanted an attorney, and he declined. He was told that if he didn't have the money with which to hire an attorney, then an attorney would be appointed for him. And it is somehow suggested here that because the judge went a little bit further, and instead of just saying generally, if you can't afford an attorney, one will be appointed to you, but instead said, if you don't meet, if you meet the requirements of the public defender's office, one will be appointed for you. But that somehow should be held against him. I just think that's more specific.
I read that, counsel, I didn't see where one will be appointed for you. I think that I'll have to go back to the language, but it wasn't quite that clear. It said if your income and assets, I'm assuming I'm reading this one on 112.
Page 3.
Yeah. And let me just read it. If your income and assets are at the level the state public defender sets, the public defender would represent you. You may, however, waive your right to an attorney and proceed without one. Am I on the...
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, but here's what you're saying. But if you wish to have an attorney, the court would take steps for you and go out and get one. And that's what you're... Okay.
Yes.
You're assuming that that's the appointed part.
I think so, and I think that's an entirely fair...
And then it follows up with, do you wish to...
Right, right. Without question, Justice Wilcox, Judge Schmidt did not say the court will appoint one for you. He didn't use the word appoint, but he said the public defender will represent you if you can't afford an attorney.
Isn't the judge required to determine that the defendant understands the risks and the benefits of proceeding pro se versus with counsel?
That's the law now. It was not at the time of this plea hearing. My opponent has referred to, that's the Klessig case that deals with this, and as Judge Grover found when he denied the collateral challenge in this case, the Klessig case was decided after the plea proceedings that took place in 1996 in this case. And yes, subsequent to the Klessig decision, courts were put on notice, and they are told in the bench book now that they are to inform a defendant who is waiving counsel of the dangers of the advantages of having counsel and the dangers of waiving counsel and proceeding without them. But that was not the law at the time.
You want to talk about Hahn, I know that, but I'm not going to let you off the hook. What about the constitutionality argument?
Okay, all right. And
do it quickly and then get to Hahn.
Okay, all right. Our view is that a defendant, of course, has a constitutional right to appear in court at all critical stages of the case. We know, however, that a defendant can, under certain circumstances, waive that right. This court has held that a defendant, by his or her own conduct, can waive an appearance, even a trial, the right to appearance at trial. We've dealt with questions dealing with what happens to a defendant who has escaped, what happens to a defendant who is disruptive in court. There are a number of circumstances in which it is clear that the right, constitutional right to presence at critical even at critical stages of a case, can be waived. So we don't for a moment dispute the notion that the defendant has a constitutional right to appear in court.
Does that mean be physically present?
No, Your Honor, it believes, our view is that there are circumstances in which the right to appear can be fully satisfied by appearance via electronic means that ensure that the proceedings that are being conducted are fair, just, and complete. That may have to be dealt with on a case-by-case basis because the state is not interested in suggesting that this court should hold that televised trials with a defendant appearing at a remote location should now be authorized. I think there are severe problems, and this court has noted that in other circumstances. In the post-conviction evidentiary hearing area, this court held that a defendant should not, even though the defendant wasn't required to be present for the post-conviction evidentiary hearing, this court held that the defendant should have been present and shouldn't, his presence at the hearing shouldn't have been conducted by telephone because there were matters of fact that needed to be dealt with. But in this case, there aren't any. So our view is, yes, you have a constitutional right to appear under the state and federal constitution, but that in many circumstances, that right may be satisfied by appearance via, under the terms of the statute, live audiovisual means.
Well, under the terms of the statute also includes telephonic. It's the state's position that if the defendant here had appeared just by telephone, but that would be, I mean, because the statute deals with telephonic and audio, live audiovisual. So is it the state's position if the defendant just appeared by telephone, that that would satisfy the constitutional right of the defendant?
I'm going to give you a really squishy answer. Maybe.
How about telephone and a pretty fuzzy video pickup? Is that sufficient?
I think that has to be part of the analysis of a case to determine whether or not the proceeding that was conducted by those means provided an opportunity for a fair and just hearing.
Well,
if the technology doesn't work very well, then the hearing doesn't work.
You've said maybe, and that actually concerns me. So tell me why that a defendant appearing pursuant to the statute that allows appearances by telephone or live audiovisual, that a defendant appearing from a remote location by telephone only satisfies the constitutional mandates.
Okay. It depends on what the nature of the proceeding is. If your question is, Your Honor, whether or not the defendant is appearing for plea and sentencing, I've got real problems with it. I have real problems with it, and I think the defense...
Telephone is not okay necessarily in this case.
Not necessarily.
Audiovisual is.
Good heavens, especially not if it's a cell phone.
But audiovisual is, or you think in this...
I think properly functioning...
Have you ever seen...
Properly functioning audiovisual...
Have you ever seen this audiovisual?
I haven't seen it.
You haven't seen the tape?
I haven't seen it.
I don't see it as part of this record, but maybe it is.
No, it's not.
Okay,
to my,
so
to my
how
knowledge,
can we decide whether or not it satisfies the constitutional right here?
Well, first of all, and I am going to get to Hahn, I don't think you have to.
Okay, let's get to Hahn.
Okay, but number two, if you were required, if you do reach that issue, I think it is a very fair question about where the burden lies at this point. Enough time went on, of course, in this case, between the plea and the collateral challenge that some question may have arisen as to the existence of the tape. I don't know what Shawnee-Menominee officials do, what their policy is with respect to the maintenance of these tapes. The issue did not come up in this case. I don't know whether one exists or not. If the evidence, if a tape existed, would it be material evidence to look at to determine how fair the proceeding was? It certainly would.
Okay.
It certainly would.
Well, even if it existed, how can we make a determination? I mean, the tape, if it exists, is only going to show some of what was on the defendant's end of that camera, right?
That's a fair point.
I mean, we won't see if there were some jailers standing outside of camera range with, you know, clubs or guns at his head to get him to plead guilty. I'm not suggesting that that occurred, but it only tells us part of the picture, which
is
part of the problem.
It's true. It's true. And in fact, I do not know, Justice Sykes, whether or not two tapes were made, one showing what the defendant sees of the judge, and one showing what the judge sees of the defendant. I don't know the answer to that question. And frankly, I think this is an area in which either pursuant to this court's rulemaking authority or the legislature in the... ...to ensure that the live audiovisual means of the enforcement of this statute really be coordinated and organized pursuant to some rules that mandate or that provide better assurances of the maintenance of evidence of how a proceeding is conducted.
The Judicial Council has that presently before it as to the judicial, as to appropriate rules.
They are considering amending the statute. That a bill has been drafted, but it has not yet been introduced.
Okay. So let's get back to Hahn.
Okay.
All this may be not necessary if you say Hahn prevents us from doing it. Let me just ask you first, can the defendant go back in any other forum and open up that 1996 conviction?
I don't know.
Pardon me?
I don't know.
I don't know. If you don't know, who knows?
The defendant might.
Okay. What would you suggest the defendant do?
Until early this morning during breakfast, when it came to me that it is conceivable that this defendant still could have a means of going back and challenging, I've been prepared to say to this court, now I doubt that he has any means of doing so. But I suppose it's possible. I came to the conclusion that he might when I read through the two transcripts that form the slim record in this case. And when at the second hearing in this case, it was noted that Mr. Peters still has a lot of fines to pay off in Shawnee County, somewhere between $4,000 and $6,500 in fines, some of which may very well have been the fines that were imposed upon him in 1996 in this case. Even though he has fully served the 35 days of jail time that were imposed upon him in 1996, he may have unpaid fines for which he is still subject to a jail commitment for non-payment. If that is the case, I believe he is in custody under the original not totally satisfied judgment and would still have an opportunity to go back to the Shawano County Circuit Court and challenge.
Would it bring habeas? That's the point of the custody.
He might, yes, he might. It would be custody perhaps sufficient for a 974-06 motion or custody sufficient for a habeas petition. And I don't know the answer to that question.
Do you have any authority to support that suggestion?
What,
the existence of unpaid fines overrides all of the other procedural bars that are necessarily in place at this stage?
Well, I'm offering... By procedural bars here, we're talking about the key procedural bar here is whether or not he is any longer in custody. And what I'm suggesting, Justice Sykes, is that there is a thin possibility that if fines are still unpaid, and he may be subject to commitment for failure to pay those fines, he may be in custody within the meaning of 974-06. Do I have a specific case to give you for that? No. That's why my answer to the question of whether or not he is... whether he has any remedies is a very definite, I don't know. It would appear that by virtue of the fact that he served his jail time a long time ago, that that actual physical restraint on him is gone. Whether or not the continuing existence of an obligation to pay fines and possibly the possibility that he could be jailed for not doing so.
Can you be jailed for... inability to pay fines?
Not if you're indigent, but for willful failure to pay fines, yes.
But then that doesn't wipe out the failure to pay the fine, does it? I mean, you still, I mean,
well, in most
your
cases,
argument seems to suggest that if there are fines yet to be paid, he can be jailed as a result of the non-payment of fines?
Only if a determination is made that he's financially able to pay those fines and is refusing to do so.
What you're saying is that there'll be a proceeding.
There could be a proceeding.
By the state.
That's right.
To collect fines.
That's right.
And in that proceeding, the or maybe the defendant will bring a proceeding saying, I don't want to pay these fines and I'm not paying them because my conviction was invalid, right?
Right.
And then that's the way to open the conviction, maybe.
Maybe. And under Hahn, I don't believe, and I'm not simply trying to say, oh, their problem, not mine, but under Hahn, it's their problem, not mine. This court made clear in Hahn that it is the defendant who has to show, or it has to be shown, that the defendant has no other remedy or is not in custody, and then only in those circumstances could the defendant come back to the court in which the prior conviction is being used to enhance a new sentence and seek to reopen that sentence. So,
do you get around your waiver? You didn't raise this before.
I think we did. I disagree with the defendant completely on that issue. The question of what she's referring to is waiver, whether we raise the Hahn issue. Of course, Hahn wasn't decided. Baker was the law when this case came up through the Court of Appeals.
Well, sure, but in Huebner, the law was 6-person jury, too.
Sure.
And the defendant didn't raise it. And then in another case, the court said that's invalid. And the court said, too bad, you should have foreseen that as a issue. This was floating in the legal air.
Mm-hmm.
There were cases pending.
Mm-hmm.
You, defendant, should have raised that. If you didn't raise it, you're out of here.
Yep,
so now the state, Hahn was in the air.
Mm-hmm.
Baker was a case here. Custis had been decided by the U.S. Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm.
Custis cast doubt on Baker because Baker relied on federal cases.
Mm-hmm.
Custis cast doubt. It was in the air that Baker was not good. Therefore, you could have raised it. And the state should have known. I mean, that's I know the state's big and there are a lot of cases pending. State was challenging Baker at about this time.
Mm-hmm.
through the court system, and yet the state here did not raise it. So why shouldn't you hold them to the same rule as Huebner?
I think we did raise it.
All right, where?
We didn't say that State versus Hahn may overturn State versus Baker, because, of course, State versus Baker was, until overturned, the binding law of the state.
Right.
But the question is, what did we or did we not raise? Mm-hmm. At the 1999 hearing on the defendant's motion, the only hearing that was held in 1999, on the defendant's motion to collaterally challenge the prior conviction, which, when denied, became a plea and sentencing hearing, the state specifically objected to the closed-circuit television argument being used as a basis for collaterally challenging the prior conviction. The state specifically said that at page 6 of the transcript, where the state said, Mr. Peters, the paragraph reads, prosecutor, Your Honor, I don't believe that this, the motion that Mr. Holden, the defense attorney, is making, provides for the conclusion that he reaches, that is, that it provides a basis for collaterally challenging a prior conviction. Mr. Peters may have a motion that is valid if he wanted to withdraw that plea. However, for purposes of using it for penalty enhancements, and then the word got appears, it's got the correct remedy. I think that's an error in the transcript, and the state is saying it's not the correct remedy. The state here was specifically objecting at the collateral challenge that this was not, the ground of the collateral challenge was not one that the defendant could rely upon to challenge the prior conviction. I think the state did raise. That's what the Hahn issue is. What are the grounds upon which one can collaterally challenge a prior conviction?
No reference to Baker.
There's no reference to Baker.
In the
trial court, there's no reference to either of the cases, either to a future Hahn case or to Baker. But I think the clear implication of the prosecutor's comments is that under the law that existed at the time, which was Baker, what the defendant here was challenging was not a ground upon which you could collaterally challenge a prior conviction.
But that's right. But the ground was that it didn't fulfill Baker, which mm-hmm. was a reliability. It wasn't that you have no right to challenge this collaterally on the ground that you can only do it on counsel.
Well, I don't read it that narrowly, because this followed a discussion, or was part of a discussion, in which the state was making clear that there had been an effective waiver of the right to counsel here. So the state's view was that certainly isn't a ground for overturning. I mean, at the time that this proceeding took place, there were two grounds, apparently, in Wisconsin upon which you could collaterally challenge a prior conviction: involuntary plea and denial of counsel. The state is arguing there was no denial of counsel here. There was a waiver of counsel, a fully effective waiver of counsel. And this closed-circuit TV argument, I was denied my right to a personal appearance, doesn't fall into either of the two categories that the law allowed at that time. I don't view this as a waiver at all.
Well, Hahn says you couldn't even have the second one, the second challenge.
Once Hahn was decided by this court, right.
That's right. So you didn't really make the Hahn challenge, that nothing was allowed except counsel.
Well, nothing that this defendant was raising satisfied any then-existent legal requirements for the two limited grounds upon which you could collaterally challenge a prior conviction. In other words, we are saying you can't do this. He might have a basis for going back and directly challenging his plea by seeking to withdraw it, but that ground is no good for a collateral challenge. And that is precisely what this court ultimately held in Hahn when it overruled Baker and said there is one ground only upon which you have a constitutional right to collaterally challenge a prior conviction being used to enhance a sentence. So we don't think we waived the issue. The issue is, what are the grounds on which you can collaterally challenge a prior conviction? From the start in 1999 in this case, we have the prosecutor, without a specific reference to Baker, to be sure, the prosecutor specifically saying the grounds this defendant is raising cannot be used to collaterally challenge. We don't think the state waived it at all.
What was your reference to which hearing was this? What date?
This is the hearing on May 25, 1999.
Before Grover.
Before Judge Grover.
What page?
Page 6. The paragraph is at lines 7 through 12.
Your Honor, I don't believe that this, the motion that Mr. Holden is making, provides for the conclusion he reaches.
Right.
Mr. Peters may have a motion that is valid if he wants to withdraw that plea. However, for purposes of using it for penalty enhancement, it's not the correct remedy. And that, you say, will advise the judge of the Baker et al. Argument. That's
well,
your position.
Well, is this the best argument that could have been made? No. But did this state what the state's view that this was not a circumstance in which a collateral challenge could be brought? Yes. Would it have been better if the prosecutor had cited Baker? Of course. Would it have been better if the prosecutor had cited Hahn? Yes. But did this advise the court that this was, in the state's view, the closed circuit TV argument that was being raised here was not a ground upon which a collateral challenge could be based? It certainly did. I think it did, in all fairness. Now, the question then is, what do we do about this case? If Hahn applies, and I think under the routine rules of application of new decisions, Hahn does apply to this case. This case was in the pipeline. It wasn't final when Hahn was decided. I think it's perfectly clear that this collateral challenge that the defendant has brought here is improper. The ground that the defendant is challenging his prior conviction on is not denial of counsel. Can't do it. The question then becomes, does he have any other remedy? And under this court's modified penultimate sentence in paragraph 28 of Hahn, the defendant can go back. That's actually a shorthand expression for, I think, that key sentence, the penultimate sentence in paragraph 28. This court changed it because it initially said that if a defendant went back and was unsuccessful in challenging, he might come back and seek to reopen, and the court eliminated that. But the court has said the defendant can go back, and by whatever means may be available under state law, in the old conviction, and seek to challenge it. And the court then went on to say, if the merits aren't reached, either because of an Escalona bar or because the defendant is not in custody, the defendant can come back and seek to reopen. Now, I'd like respectfully to suggest to the court let me step back. Number one, I think this defendant is out of luck. The game is over. If this defendant has no means back in the circuit court to directly challenge the 1996 conviction. If I'm wrong about custody and the possibility of still, because of the existence of unpaid fines, of still challenging.
No luck, Mr. Gansner, because he can't win on the merits. That's your position.
Well, I want to respectfully raise to the court a question that has arisen since this court modified that penultimate sentence in paragraph 28, which is, the court said, if the defendant doesn't have a means of challenging that conviction, he can come back to the enhanced sentencing court and seek to reopen the sentence. And the court said that we offer no opinion on what the disposition of that effort would be. Unless this court is suggesting that on a motion to reopen, the defendant has a greater opportunity to challenge than back in a challenge to the direct case itself, I think, frankly, prosecutors in the lower courts are a little bit at sea as to what that means. Our view is that if the opportunity for collateral review is gone because the defendant is not raising the one claim that can be raised on collateral review, and if there is no opportunity to challenge, if the time for challenging the conviction directly back in the original court of conviction is gone, or if the defendant has made the effort and has been unsuccessful on the merits, our view is the game is over. This defendant has had the opportunity of everything the law provides to challenge that prior conviction. This defendant, like many defendants who seek to collaterally challenge a prior conviction, saw no reason to challenge that prior conviction until years later the state wanted to rely upon it. There's the time for directly challenging it is in all likelihood gone, and the opportunity is evaporated. This defendant now has an incentive to challenge, but the one opportunity the law constitutionally provides is a collateral challenge, and that collateral challenge is limited to a claim of denial of counsel.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Gansner.
Over. Thank you. I appreciate the court's giving me the additional time.
Smith. Ms. Smith, a.k.a. White.
Sorry.
You've been called lots of things. That's a new one.
Name of your choosing.
The first thing that worries me, Your Honor, is that at this date, and for the first time today, counsel says, now let's go revisit Veneman. We've talked waiver here before, but dear Lord, that one should be waived. There has been no request anywhere in here by the state to revisit the question of what physical, what presence means in 97104. And if what they are suggesting is that physical presence and presence by audiovisual means are equivalent, I urge the court to review the court of the Third District Court of Appeals decision in Gutendorf, and also the language in Seymour, the Florida case that the Court of Appeals cites, where they talk about the limits of audiovisual means, particularly for the most important proceeding in this case, which is the combination plea and sentencing. The court talks about the nuances and the ability to look people in the eye. And when you have a camera, the one's on the court, on the judge, and one's on the defendant, and particularly in this case where the defendant's negotiating the plea bargain with the DA, that's simply not good enough. It should not be deemed equivalent, particularly whereas here, if you say that, and you say that's sufficient to use the 96708 procedures, they do allow telephones. It doesn't cut it, and it shouldn't cut it. Secondly, counsel says that you can waive that right. Sure, you can waive it, but waiver means a freely given waiver of a known right. There clearly was no waiver here. The guy was in jail. He had been in jail. He couldn't make bond, and the only way out, from his point of view, was to plead guilty. The cases that talk about waiver of the right to be present are cases like Divinovic, where the court sent the DA and the bailiff, or not the DA, the defense attorney and the bailiff to tell the guy, please come to court, and he refused. Or the guy who acts like an idiot in front of the trial court, and the judge says, you do that again, Mr. Defendant, and I'm going to send you out of here, and you're going to have to do it by TV. There was no waiver here. And if a defendant tried to claim that they had raised an issue by the language Ms. White, and that's where you get White from, it's Catherine White, the prosecutor initially here, the language she did on page 6 of the May 25th hearing, that you'd laugh us out of court. That clearly did not raise the issue of Custis, which had been decided before, or the Baker issue. There's no way that put anybody on notice. The question here is relatively simple. The state sought to enhance Mr. Peters' 1999 conviction by using the 1996 conviction. And his request was, that's not reliable enough for you to punish me again. That's different from seeking to go back and completely void the proceeding. Under the circumstances here, where the question is, was it a fair, sufficiently fair and just proceeding? When you look at all the circumstances, you can say that there might be a challenge if he didn't pay the fines. And if there were, in fact, fines that were unpaid, I don't think there's any way we can find that that would create an opportunity to go back to the trial court. And I think the answer to that clearly is to look at the file in this case. I'm appointed by the public defender's office. There's no money there. whatever those fines are, he can't even pay me. We're looking first at the Hahn question. Did the state waive the issue at all? And I think clearly they did. There is no indication anywhere in the record till the Court of Appeals decision that mentions Hahn that even brings up the issue of revisiting Baker. Not a thing. Secondly, if you read the penultimate paragraph, the amended paragraph, the way the state asks you to, the second sentence doesn't mean anything. The second sentence doesn't mean anything at all. Because clearly, the one right that you preserved under Baker can't be the subject of that. If he can't go back to the trial court, and there's no serious suggestion here that he could, should he be foreclosed from being punished a second time on what might be a constitutionally invalid procedure? That's not such a tremendous burden to impose on a trial court, given the cost to the individual. And that's what the system's about.
Thank you, Ms. Smith. Thank you, Mr. Gansner. And thank you to the people of Oneida County. You've had a wonderful time. We will now go into the conference room and tentatively decide these cases. See you both in Madison. Thank you.